The Arch-Chancellor made himself comfortable at his snooker table. He'd long ago got rid of the official desk. A snooker table was much to be preferred. Things didn't fall off the edge. There were a number of handy pockets to keep sweets and things in, and when he was bored he could shovel the paperwork off and set up trick shots. He was a wizard. Trick shots for a wizard aren't the old three-times-round-the-table jobs. His best one was once off the cushion, once off a seagull, once off the back of the head of the bursar who'd been walking along the corridor outside last Tuesday, a bit of a temporal spin there, and a tricky rebound off the ceiling. He'd missed sinking the actual shot by a whisker, but it had been pretty tricky, even so. He never bothered to shovel the paperwork back on afterwards. In his experience, anything really important never got written down, because by then people were too busy shouting. He picked up his pen and started to write. He was composing his memoirs. He'd got as far as the title. Along the Ankh, with bow, rod, and staff with a knob on the end. "Not many people realize," he wrote, "that the River Ankh has a large and varied piscine population." And this was true. Nature can adapt to practically anything. There were fish evolved to live in the river. They looked like a cross between a soft-shelled crab and an industrial vacuum cleaner, and tended to explode in fresh water, and what you had to use for bait was nobody's business. But they were fish, and a sportsman like Ridcully never cared about what the quarry tasted like. He flung down the pen and stormed along the corridor into the dean's office. "What the hell's that?" he shouted. The dean jumped. "'It's a guitar, Arch-Chancellor," said the dean, walking hurriedly backwards as Ridcully approached. "I just bought it. I can see that. I can hear that. What was it you were trying to do?" "I was practicing, riffs," said the dean. He waved a badly printed woodcut defensively in Ridcully's face. The Arch-Chancellor grabbed it. "Blurt Weedown's Guitar Primer," he read. "Play your way to success in 3 easy leftsons and 18 hard leftsons. Well, I've nothing against guitars, pleasant airs, espying young maidens one morning in May and so on, but that wasn't playing, that was just noise. I mean, what was it supposed to be?" "A lick based on an E pentatonic scale using the major seventh as a passing tone," said the dean. The Arch-Chancellor peered at the open page. "But this says, Lesson 1, Fairy Footsteps," he said. "I was getting a bit impatient," said the dean. "You've never been musical, Dean," said Ridcully. "It's one of your good points. Why the sudden inch... What have you got on your feet?" The dean looked down. "I thought you were a bit taller," said Ridcully. "You standing on a couple of planks?" "They're just... thick soles," said the dean. Just something the dwarfs invented, I suppose. I don't know, I found them in my closet. Modo, the gardener, says he thinks they're crepe." "That's strong language for Modo, but I'd say he's right enough." "No, it's a kind of rubbery stuff," said the dean dismally.
Excuse me, Arch-Chancellor?"
It was the bursar standing in the doorway. A large red-faced man was behind him, craning over his shoulder.
"What is it, bursar?"
This gentleman has got a..."
"It's about your monkey," said the man.
Ridcully brightened up.
"Oh, yes. Apparently, he removed some wheels from this gentleman's carriage,"
said the bursar, who was on the depressive side of his mental cycle.
"You sure it was the librarian?"
said the Arch-Chancellor.
"Fat, red hair, says ook a lot."
That's him. Oh, dear. I wonder why he did that," said Ridcully. "Still, you know what they say, a 500-pound gorilla can sleep where he likes."
"But a 300-pound monkey can give me my bloody wheels back," said the man, unmoved. "If I don't get my wheels back, there's going to be trouble."
Trouble?"
said Ridcully.
"Yeah. And don't think you can scare me. Wizards don't scare me. Everyone knows there's a rule that you mustn't use magic against civilians.
The man thrust his face close to Ridcully and raised a fist. Ridcully snapped his fingers. There was an inrush of air and a croak.
I've always thought of it more as a guideline, he said mildly.
Bursa, go and put this frog in the flowerbed, and when he becomes his old self, give him $10.
$10 would be all right, wouldn't it?
Croak, said the frog hastily.
Good. And now, will someone tell me what's going on? There was a series of crashes from downstairs.
Why do I think, said Ridcully to the world in general, that this isn't going to be the answer?
The servants had been laying the tables for lunch. This generally took some time. Since wizards took their meals seriously and left a lot of mess, the tables were in a permanent state of being laid, cleaned, or occupied. Place settings alone took a lot of time. Each wizard required 9 knives, 13 forks, 12 spoons, and 1 rammer, quite apart from all the wine glasses. Wizards often turned up in ample time for the next meal. In fact, they were often there in good time to have second helpings of the last one. A wizard was sitting there now.
"That's recent runes, ain't it?" said Ridcully.
He had a knife in each hand. He also had the salt, pepper and mustard pots in front of him, and the cake stand, and a couple of tureen covers, all of which he was hitting vigorously with the knives.
"What's he doing that for?" said Ridcully. "And, Dean, will you stop tapping your feet?"
"Well, it's catchy," said the Dean.
"It's catching," said Ridcully.
The lecturer in recent runes was frowning in concentration. Forks jangled across the woodwork, a spoon caught a glancing blow, pinwheeled through the air, and hit the bursar on the ear.
"What the hells does he think he's doing?"
"That really hurt."
The wizards clustered around the lecturer in recent runes. He paid them no attention whatsoever. Sweat poured down his beard.
"He just broke the cruet," said Ridcully.
"It's going to smart for hours."
"Ah, yes, he's as hot as mustard," said the Dean.
"I'd take that with a pinch of salt," said the senior wrangler.
Ridcully straightened up. He raised a hand.
"Now someone's about to say something like, 'I hope the watch don't catch up with him, aren't you?' he said. Or, 'That's a bit of a sauce.' Or, 'I bet you're all trying to think of something silly to say about pepper.' I'd just like to know what's the difference between this faculty and a bunch of pea-brained idiots."
"Ha, ha, ha," said the bursar nervously, still rubbing his ear.
It wasn't a rhetorical question.
Ridcully snatched the knives out of the lecturer's hands. The man went on beating the air for a moment and then appeared to wake up.
Hello, Arch-Chancellor. Is there a problem?"
"What are you doing?"
The lecturer looked down at the table.
"He was syncopating," said the Dean.
"I never was."
Ridcully frowned. He was a thick-skinned, single-minded man, with the tact of a sledgehammer and about the same sense of humour, but he was not stupid, and he knew that wizards were like weather vanes, or the canaries that miners used to detect pockets of gas. They were, by their nature, tuned to an occult frequency. If there was anything strange happening, it tended to happen to wizards. They turned, as it were, to face it, or dropped off their perch.
"Why is everyone suddenly so musical?" he said, using the term in its loosest sense, of course.
He looked at the assembled wizardry, and then down towards the floor.
"You've all got crepe on your shoes."
The wizards looked at their feet with some surprise.
"My word, I thought I was a bit taller," said the senior wrangler. "I put it down to the celery diet."
The senior wrangler had a theory that long food, beans, celery, and rhubarb, made you taller because of the famous doctrine of signatures. It certainly made him lighter.
"Proper footwear for a wizard is pointy shoes or good stout boots," said Ridcully. "When one's footwear turns creepy, something's amiss."
"It's crepe," said the Dean. "It's got a little pointy thingy over the..."
Ridcully breathed heavily.
"When your boots change by themselves," he growled.
"There's magic afoot?"
"Ha, ha, ha! Good one, senior wrangler," said the Dean.
"I want to know what's going on," said Ridcully, in a low and level voice, "and if you don't all shut up, there will be trouble."
He reached into the pockets of his robe, and after a few false starts, produced a pocket thermometer. He held it up. There was always a high level of background magic in the university, but the little needle was on the normal mark. On average, anyway. It was ticking backwards and forwards across it like a metronome. Aridkali held it up so they could all see. "What's this?" he said.
4-4 time?" said the dean.
"Music ain't magic," said Aridkali. "Don't be daft. Music's twanging and banging and—" He stopped.
"Has anyone got anything they should be telling me?"
The wizards shuffled their blue suede feet nervously.
"Well," said the senior wrangler, "it is a fact that last night, some of us, happened to be passing by the, mended drum."
"Bona fide travellers,"
said the lecturer in recent runes.
"It's allowable for bona fide travellers to get a drink at licensed premises at any hour of day or night. City statute, you know."
"Where were you travelling from, then?" Aridkali demanded.
The bunch of grapes."
"That's just around the corner."
"Yes, but we were tired."
All right," said Aridkali, in the voice of a man who knows that pulling at a thread any more will cause the whole vest to unravel. "The librarian was with you?"
"Oh, yes."
"Go on."
"Well, there was this music."
"Sort of twangy," said the senior wrangler. "Melody led," said the dean.
"It was sort of, in a way, it
kind of gets under your skin and makes you feel fizzy," said the dean. "Incidentally, has anyone got any black paint? I've looked everywhere."
"Under your skin," murmured Aridkali. He scratched his chin. "Oh, dear, one of those. Stuff leaking into the universe again, eh? Influences coming from outside, yes? Remember what happened when Mr. Hong opened his takeaway fish bar on the site of the old temple in Dagon Street? And then there were those moving pictures. I was against them from the start. All those wire things on wheels. This universe has more damn holes in it than a quirm cheese. Well, it's
Lankra cheese," said the senior wrangler, helpfully. "That's the one with holes. Quirm is the one with the blue veins."
Aridkali gave him a look.
"Actually, it didn't feel magical," said the dean. He sighed. He was 72. It had made him feel that he was 17 again.
He couldn't remember having been 17. It was something that must have happened to him while he was busy. But it made him feel like he imagined it felt like when you were 17, which was like having a permanent red-hot vest on under your skin. He wanted to hear it again.
"I think they're going to have it again tonight," he ventured. "We could go along and listen in order to learn more about it, in case it's a threat to society," he added virtuously.
That's right, Dean," said the lecturer in recent runes. It's our civic duty. We're the city's first line of supernatural defence. Supposing ghastly creatures started coming out of the air?"
"What about it?" said the chair of indefinite studies.
"Well, we'd be there."
"Yes, that's good, is it?"
Aridkali glared at his wizards. Two of them were surreptitiously tapping their feet, and several of them appeared to be twitching very gently. The bursar twitched gently all the time, of course, but that was only his way. "Like canaries," he thought, "or lightning conductors."
"All right," he said reluctantly, "we'll go, but we won't draw attention to ourselves."
"Certainly, Arch-Chancellor."
"And everyone's to buy their own drink."
"Oh."
Corporal, possibly Cotton, saluted in front of the fort sergeant, who was trying to shave.
"It's the new recruit, sir," he said. "He won't obey orders."
The sergeant nodded and then looked blankly at something in his own hand.
"Razor, sir," said the corporal helpfully. "He just keeps on saying things like, 'It's not happening yet.'"
"Have you tried burying him up to his neck in sand? That usually works."
"It's a bit, nasty to people. Oh, had it a moment ago.
The corporal snapped his fingers.
Cruel, that's it. We don't give people the pit these days."
"This is the—"
The sergeant glanced at the palm of his left hand, where there were several lines of writing.
The Foreign Legion."
"Yes, sir. All right, sir. He's weird.
He just sits there all the time. We call him Beau Nidal, sir.
Sergeant peered bemusedly at the mirror.
It is your face, sir, said the corporal.
Susan stared at herself critically. Susan. It wasn't a good name, was it? It wasn't a truly bad name. It wasn't like poor old Iodine in the fourth form, or Nigella, a name which means, oops, we wanted a boy. But it was dull. Susan. Sue. Good old Sue. It was a name that made sandwiches, kept its head in difficult circumstances, and could reliably look after other people's children. It was a name used by no queens or goddesses anywhere. And you couldn't do much even with the spelling. You could turn it into Susie, and it sounded as though you danced on tables for a living. You could put in a Z and a couple of N's and an E, but it still looked like a name with extensions built on. It was as bad as Sarah, a name that cried out for a prosthetic H. Well, at least she could do something about the way she looked. It was the robe. It might be traditional, but she wasn't. The alternative was her school uniform, or one of her mother's pink creations. The baggy dress of the Quirm College for Young Ladies was a proud one, and in the mind of Miss Butts, at least, proof against all the temptations of the flesh. But it lacked a certain panache as a costume for the ultimate reality, and pink was not even to be thought of. For the first time in the history of the universe, a death wondered about what to wear. "Hold on," she said to her reflection. "Yeah, I can create things, can't I?" She held out her hand and thought, "Cup." A cup appeared. It had a skull and bones pattern around the rim. "Ah," said Susan, "I suppose a pattern of roses is out of the question. Probably not right for the ambience, I expect." She put the cup on the dressing table and tapped it. It went plink in a solid sort of way. "Well then," she said, "I don't want something soppy and posy. No silly black lace or anything worn by idiots who write poetry in their rooms and dress like vampires and are vegetarians, really." The images of clothes floated across her reflection. It was clear that black was the only option, but she settled on something practical and without frills. She put her head on one side critically. Well, maybe a bit of lace," she said, "and perhaps a bit more bodice." She nodded at her reflection in the mirror. Certainly it was a dress that no Susan would ever wear, although she suspected that there was a basic Susan-ness about her which would permeate it after a while. "It's a good job you're here," she said, "or I'd go totally mad. Ha ha ha." Then she went to see her grandfather. Death. There was one place he had to be. Glod wandered quietly into the university library. Dwarfs respected learning, provided they didn't have to experience it. He tugged at the robe of a passing young wizard.
"There's a monkey runs this place, right?" he said. "Big, fat, hairy monkey. Hands a couple of octaves wide."
The wizard, a pasty-faced postgraduate student, looked down at Glod with the disdainful air a certain type of person always reserves for dwarfs. It wasn't much fun being a student in Unseen University. You had to find your pleasures where you could. He grinned a big, wide, innocent grin.
"Why, yes," he said. "I do believe right at this moment he's in his workroom in the basement. But you have to be very careful how you address him."
"Is that so?" said Glod.
"Yes, you have to be sure to say, 'Do you want a peanut, Mr. Monkey?'"
said the student wizard. He signalled a couple of his colleagues.
"That's so, isn't it? He has to say, 'Mr. Monkey.'"
Oh, yes indeedy," said a student. "Actually, if you don't want him to get annoyed, it's best to be on the safe side and scratch under your arms. That puts him at his ease."
And go, "Urg, urg, urg," said a third student. "He likes that."
Well, thank you very much," said Glod. "Which way do I go?"
"We'll show you," said the first student.
"That's so very kind.
Don't mention it. Only too glad to help."
The three wizards led Glod down a flight of steps and into a tunnel. Light filtered down through the occasional pane of green glass set in the floor above. Every so often, Glod heard a snigger behind him. The librarian was squatting down on the floor in a long, high cellar. Miscellaneous items had been scattered on the floor in front of him. There was a cartwheel, odd bits of wood and bone, and various pipes, rods, and lengths of wire that somehow suggested that around the city people were puzzling over broken pumps and fences with holes in. The librarian was chewing the end of a piece of pipe and looking intently at the heap.
"That's him," said one of the wizards, giving Glod a push.
The dwarf shuffled forward. There was another outburst of muffled giggling behind him. He tapped the librarian on the shoulder.
"Excuse me."
"Ooh?"
"Those guys just called you a monkey," said Glod, jerking a thumb in the direction of the door. "I'd make them say sorry if I was you."
There was a creaking metallic noise, followed very closely by a scuffling outside as the wizards trampled one another in their effort to get away. The librarian had bent the pipe into a U-shape, apparently without effort. Glod went to the door and looked out. There was a pointy hat on the flagstones, trampled flat.
"That was fun," he said. "If I'd just asked them where the librarian was, they'd have said, 'Bugger off, you dwarf. You have to know how to deal with people in this game.'"
He came back and sat down beside the librarian. The ape put a smaller bend in the pipe.
"What are you making?" said Glod.
"Ook, ook, ook, ook."
"My cousin Modo is the gardener here," said Glod. "He says you're a mean keyboard player."
He stared at the hands busy in the pipe bending. They were big. And of course there were four of them.
"He was certainly partly right," he added.
The ape picked up a length of driftwood and tasted it.
"We thought you might like to play, pianoforte with us at the drum tonight," said Glod. "Me and Cliff and Buddy, that is."
The librarian rolled a brown eye towards him, then picked up a piece of wood, gripped one end, and began to strum.
"Ook?"
"That's right," said Glod. "The boy with the guitar."
"Ook, ook, ook."
The librarian did a back somersault.
"Ook, ook, 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 ook."
"I can see you're in the swing of it already," said Glod.
Susan saddled the horse and mounted up. Beyond Death's garden were fields of corn, their golden sheen the only colour in the landscape. Death might not have been any good at grass, black, and apple trees, gloss black on black, but all the depth of colour he hadn't put elsewhere he'd put in the fields. They rippled as if in the wind, except that there wasn't any wind. Susan couldn't imagine why he'd done it. There was a path, though. It led across the fields for half a mile or so, then disappeared abruptly. It looked as though somebody walked out here occasionally and just stood, looking around. Binky followed the path and stopped at the end. Then he turned, managing not to disturb a single ear.
"I don't know how you do this," Susan whispered, "but you must be able to do it, and you know where I want to go."
The horse appeared to nod. Albert had said that Binky was a genuine flesh-and-blood horse, but maybe you could be ridden by Death for hundreds of years without learning something. He looked as though he'd been pretty bright to start with. Binky began to trot, and then canter, and then gallop, and then the sky flickered just once. Susan had expected more than that, flashing stars, some sort of explosion of rainbow colours, not just a flicker. It seemed a rather dismissive way of travelling nearly 17 years. The cornfields had gone, but the garden was pretty much the same. There was the strange topiary, and the pond with the skeletal fish. There were, pushing jolly wheelbarrows and carrying tiny scythes, what might have been garden gnomes in a mortal garden, but here were cheery little skeletons in black robes. Things tended not to change. The stables were a little different, though. Binky was in them for a start. He whinnied quietly as Susan led him into an empty stall next to himself.
"I'm sure you two know each other," she said.
She'd never expected it to work. But it had to, didn't it? Time was something that happened to other people, wasn't it? She slipped into the house.
"No, I cannot be bidden. I cannot be forced. I will only do that which I know to be right."
Susan crept along behind the shelves of lifetimers. No one noticed her. When you are watching Death fight, you don't notice shadows in the background. They'd never told her about this. Parents never do. Your father could be Death's apprentice and your mother Death's adopted daughter, but that's just fine detail when they become parents. Parents were never young. They were merely waiting to become parents. Susan reached the end of the shelves. Death was standing over her father. She corrected herself. The boy who would be her father. Three red marks burned on his cheek where Death had struck him. Susan raised a hand to the pale marks on her own face.
"But that's not how heredity works. At least the normal kind."
Her mother, the girl who would become her mother, was pressed against a pillar. She had actually improved with age, Susan thought. Her dress sense certainly had. And she mentally shook herself.
fashion comments now. Death stood over Mort, sword in one hand and Mort's own lifetimer in the other.
"You don't know how sorry this makes me," he said.
"I might," said Mort.
Death looked up and looked straight at Susan. His eye sockets flared blue for a moment. Susan tried to press herself into the shadows. He looked back down at Mort for a moment, and then at Isabel, and then back at Susan, and then back down at Mort, and laughed, and turned the hourglass over, and snapped his fingers. Mort vanished with a small pop of imploding air. So did Isabel and the others. It was suddenly very quiet. Death put the hourglass down very carefully on the table, and looked at the ceiling for a while, and then said,
"Albert?"
Albert appeared from behind a pillar.
"Would you be so good as to make me a cup of tea, please?"
"Yes, master. You sorted him out right enough."
"Thank you."
Albert scurried off in the direction of the kitchen. Once again there was the closest thing that could ever be to silence in the room of lifetimers.
"You'd better come out."
Susan did so, and stood before the ultimate reality. Death was 7 feet tall. He looked taller. Susan had vague memories of a figure carrying her on its shoulders through the huge dark rooms, but in memory it had been a human figure. Bony, but human in a way that she was certain of, but couldn't quite define. This wasn't human. It was tall and haughty and terrible. He might unbend enough to bend the rules, Susan thought, but that doesn't make him human. This is the keeper of the gate of the world, immortal by definition, the end of everything. He is my grandfather. Will be, anyway. Is. Was. But there was the thing in the apple tree. Her mind kept swinging back to that. You looked up at the figure and thought about the tree. It was almost impossible to keep both images in one mind.
"Well, well, well. You have a lot of your mother about you," said Death. "And your father."
"How did you know who I am?" said Susan.
"I have a unique memory."
"How can you remember me? I haven't even been conceived yet."
"I did say unique. Your name is..."
"Susan, but..."
"Susan?" said Death bitterly. "They really wanted to make sure, didn't they?"
He sat down in his chair, steepled his fingers, and looked at Susan over the top of them. She looked back, matching stare for stare.
"Tell me," said Death after a while, "was I, will I be, am I a good grandfather?"
Susan bit her lip thoughtfully.
"If I tell you, won't that be a paradox?"
"Not for us."
"Well, you've got bony knees."
Death stared at her.
"Bony knees?"
Sorry.
"You came here to tell me that?"
"You've gone missing, back there. I'm having to do the duty. Albert is very worried. I came here to find things out. I didn't know my father worked for you."
"He was very bad at it."
"What have you done with him?"
"They're safe for now. I'm glad it's over. Having people around was beginning to affect my judgment. Ah, Albert."
Albert had appeared on the edge of the carpet, bearing a tea tray.
"Another cup, if you would be so good."
Albert looked around and totally failed to see Susan. If you could be invisible to Miss Butts, everyone else was easy.
"If you say so, master."
"So," said Death, when Albert had shuffled away, "I have gone missing, and you believe you have inherited the family business. You."
"I didn't want to. The horse and the rat just turned up."
"Rat?"
I think that's something that's going to happen."
"Oh, yes, I remember. A human doing my job. Technically possible, of course. But why?"
"I think Albert knows something, but he changes the subject."
Albert reappeared, carrying another cup and saucer. He plonked it down pointedly on Death's desk, with the air of one who is being put upon.
"That'll be all, will it, master?" he said.
"Thank you, Albert. Yes."
Albert left again, more slowly than normal. He kept looking over his shoulder.
"He doesn't change, does he?" said Susan. "Of course, that's the point about this place."
"What do you think about cats?"
"Sorry?"
cats. Do you like 'em?
They're, Susan hesitated. All right, but a cat's just a cat.
Chocolate, said Death. Do you like chocolate?
I think it's possible to have too much, said Susan.
You certainly don't take after Isabel. Susan nodded. Her mother's favourite dish had been genocide by chocolate. And your memory? You have a good memory?
Oh, yes, I remember things. About how to be Death. About how it's all supposed to work. Look, just then you said you remembered about the rat, and it hasn't even happened.
Death stood up and strode across to the model of the Discworld. Morphic resonance, he said, not looking at Susan. Damn. People don't begin to understand it. Soul harmonics. It's responsible for so many things.